You're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Patrick Hester and Tracy Townsend.
Welcome back, friends. Please make sure your pod seat and tray table are in their upright and locked position. The airlock is sealed and docking clamps have been released for an on-time departure to the Functional Nerdverse. Hey there, nerdlings. How's it going, Patrick?
Oh, it's going. You know, we had 80 degree weather for 3 days in a row, and being Colorado, temperature dropped, the rain came in, and my sinuses went, oh, fuck you.
Of course they did. I wouldn't mind your 80 degree weather over here in Chicagoland. It has been stubbornly late wintery lately. We've been really kind of vacillating a lot. It's been making me remember from different things that I've read and different stuff that I've seen. There are certain times a year where I swear to God, Chicago is like the surface of Mars, where it's just like everything. And so I guess it's sort of appropriate that today we've got David Ebenbach with us, whose debut SF novel, not debut novel period, David's been in the trenches many times before, but his debut SF novel, How to Mars, is coming out from Tachyon on May 25th. So David, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
So I have to say, I'm super excited to talk to you about this book because it's an SF comedy, which is a sweet spot for me. I don't write SF comedy. I think it's outside of my skill range, but I love to ingest it in all of its different like media forms. And so I want to hear all about this. I want you to get everybody as hype about it as I'm hype.
Great. Let's just spend about 6-7 hours just walking through it.
Of course, yes. Just page by page.
I don't know if our listeners would like such a short episode.
Okay. Well, as long as you want, actually.
Yeah, it's fine.
You know, the thing is when you're talking about like blasting into outer space and like making little colonies on inhospitable planets, there's something inherently ridiculous and hilarious about that to me.
Yeah.
You may or may not already know this, but were you aware of the Mars One project when that was happening out in the world?
Oh, gosh. It sounds super familiar, but I'm blanking, so go for it.
So that's sort of the inspiration for this book, and it was this crazy and probably fraudulent idea to send, you know, a dozen or so folks on a one-way trip to Mars, and they were going to fund it with a reality show, and there was one rule that they couldn't have sex. And what was particularly insane about this to me was that people applied. They're like, yeah, you know, let's go away forever. We'll never come back. Some of these people had families and children, which was kind of inherently tragic. But they, you know, were all set to go. And so the ridiculousness of that was the fuel for the whole thing, really. So how can it not be a little comic to think about ideas like that, I think?
You know, I had a weirdly random but possibly not dream last night, and basically it was just me and a bunch of other people going, I'm tired of us not being on Mars yet. Let's just build some rockets and go and just see what happens, right? Yeah. And like a bunch of people just build a rocket and go, and it's kind of like the land rush. You know, it's like we're here, so what are you going to do, America?
Yeah,
you're on Mars. What are you going to do?
According to Kim Stanley Robinson, Mars is covered in valuable ore and minerals. So, I mean, it could be like a really classic land rush, minerals rush, whatever. The oxygen's not too good there, and it's kind of cold,
somewhat wanting as far
as a lot of radiation and stuff.
Yeah, but if books about Mars have taught us anything, really, all we need is some plants and some potatoes, and we can live there.
Exactly. Yeah.
And shit.
If you're Bradbury, some psychic aliens who just fade away and leave us their gorgeous
architecture. They had bee guns too, which was amazing.
Yeah,
like literally, like shot some kind of crazy Martian hornets. And I gotta say, with cicada season about to be upon us in the Midwest and towards the East Coast, I'm gonna be feeling that real hard.
I saw
the idea of weaponizing insects.
There were some shells on the ground today. I was out for a walk, and you were talking about the weather, and we have like a strong chance of cicada infestation as of now. So there were molting shells on the ground and holes that they had crawled up out of. And it's beginning. But so, you know, Bradbury, I think one of the cool things about him was that he really thrived on not knowing a damn thing about Mars. You know, like there were no probes that had gone by there. So he had people just kind of traveling to Mars in a couple of minutes. And, you know, when the Earth is blowing up at one point in the book, you can look up in the sky and it's just sort of right there. You're looking at all the stuff going on Earth. There's canals, there's bee guns and plants psychic aliens.
Families going there for a picnic to hook up with the other families. Yeah.
Right. So, you know, I think he was really glad that he didn't have any information to work with.
And not once did anybody in those books run into a white or a green Martian from DC.
That's interesting. I don't know what color the Martians were.
I think they were golden. I seem to remember them as having vaguely golden hues to their, but they were otherwise, you know, as tended to be, like in a very kind of proto Star Trek kind of way, like extremely like morphically hominid. Like they were just sort of like almost languorous Tolkien-esque elven thing, but with like a metallic sheen.
Yeah. As opposed to the shape-shifting Martians from DC's universe. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And and they had 50s style gender conceptions as well. I mean, housewife.
That was very vacuuming with pearls. Yeah.
Right. that was the other thing. He really couldn't quite get past where he was in social time and space for that book. But a lot of
trauma. To this day, I still vacuum in pearls.
Well, I mean, they look really good on you, and you don't have the legs for the fishnets, so I shouldn't say things like that. Been working entirely on podcast with you for like a year now, and I've literally never seen your legs. You might just be a torso, and I wouldn't know. I would have no way of verifying one way or the other.
Yeah, just watch the old queen video. I want to break free.
that'll do it. That'll put things in perspective. So I guess you're bringing up thinking about the Martian Chronicles and thinking about how like the 1950s imprint that's there. You know, here you are in the year of what the fuck is going on, 2021, with a book coming out with a reality TV kind of backbone to the curiosity about living in outer space and moving humanity outward and colonizing. There's got to be some ways that the world we're living in now has imprinted itself on the vision for How to Mars. And I really want to hear about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think this book may be a little bit less than what I'm working on now in the sense that Tachyon and I have been turning this into a physical book for more than a year now. So it was pretty close to final draft when the virus started to go crazy. I mean, things were pretty bonkers well before that. So I guess I shouldn't. Yeah.
Different kinds of bonkers.
Yeah, there's just bonkers here, bonkers everywhere. So
and as we're recording this, the bonkers right now is people filling plastic bags full of gasoline and taking it home in the trunk of their car.
Yeah.
The meme format I've seen circulating now is that the CDC has decided to relax the mask guidelines because they've seen all of the plastic bags of gas and gone, you know what, let's just let natural selection take its course. It's just, exactly. We're tired. We're just giving up.
Thin the herd. Yeah. You know, but there is something, I think there is a kind of underlying core insanity to the way we do everything as a species for the last, I don't know how long, that is definitely infusing the book. And for me, it's exacerbated by the situation we're in where you folks who are listening to this can't see this, but we're actually able to see each other in this as we do this interview. But this is how, Patrick could be a torso because we don't see each other's backs or lower halves. We have this kind of curated sense of one another. And yet we put a lot of weight on that. We think that's reality. We think we have something. And that's what reality TV is too. It's this curated sense of these characters that are created for TV. You know, you film them 24 hours a day and then you select 12 minutes of what they do in that day. And you can make them into anything you want if you're doing that kind of curation. And I think all the virtual nature of everything we do means that we're curating ourselves to some extent. Who are we on Twitter? Who are we on Instagram? And everywhere else, Reddit, if we choose to self-identify as Redditors. I'm interested in that discrepancy between this curated version of ourselves and who we really are. So even when you look at kind of Mars, like we're traveling to Mars, it's going to be a space adventure. And then what I was thinking about is, well, these people have been on Mars and there's not that much to do. And they're kind of bored after a while. And so they're just trying to find ways to entertain themselves. And I was interested in the sort of simpler humanity of day-to-day life rather than the the projections we try to put out there of what we're supposed to be or what we want to be seen as, I think, if that makes sense.
So since it keeps coming up, I'm just going to throw it out there. From, you know, you guys just see me from the shoulders up. From the waist down, I'm doing Lord of the Dance stuff.
It's amazing. Like, you get great shoulder control.
I'm just doing the because you got to get
your
some
control's
exercise
amazing.
In.
Your control.
You got to get some exercise in, right? Yes. You got to do it somehow, some way. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. I just wring my hands anxiously. So that's where I get my exercise.
So what sorts of entertainment do these folks end up creating for themselves?
Well, you know, the big thing is that I pretty much went with the Mars One model because I thought it was preposterous. And so they had the same rule that you're not allowed to have sex. And of course, the first line of the novel is, this is how I find out Jenny is pregnant on Mars. Because how does a rule like that even theoretically work? So that's one form of entertainment. And so that's the astrophysicist and the psychologist who then are going to, you know, have the first off-world pregnancy happening throughout the book. There's the engineer who's becoming increasingly hermit-like and disgruntled and difficult. There's the biologist who has no bio to ology. So she is just kind of getting increasingly desperate and crying in her lab. The sort of the Air Force captain who got them there is turning into a kind of a house mother and setting up chore wheels and things like that. the biologist the botanist slash geologist is trying to grow spinach in the back. And then when the baby's coming closer, is trying to make strained spinach for the baby. So, you know, just try and find your things that, you know, you try and find things to do.
You know, I'm thinking about what you were talking about before, David, with the notion of, like reality TV as this curation of experience, that it's meant to present an image of what's happening and to direct that image towards us as viewers and as people being entertained. And I've read the first chapter of the book. I was just reading it this morning. Nice. And not to spoil anything, this is like a page and a half in, so this isn't a big spoiler, but when Jenny, who is the pregnant character you mentioned, reveals her pregnancy to the most probable father of said child, who is our narrator, there's this moment where they're talking about how they were told in no uncertain terms, like, you must not have sex, like, we don't know, because clearly they were concerned about the idea of Mars baby and how viable is a pregnancy off world and so on. But at the same time, there's this pause in the conversation, and one of them looks at the other and says, but they sure did send us with a lot of pregnancy tests, didn't they?
Exactly. There's a
and
whole
so there's this,
drawer of
there's
them.
This sense that without them unpacking that comment further, that they kind of know that they knew that those guys back on Earth knew that right. stuff was going to go down, and maybe they were even sort of hoping it would go down. And so they're going to just like, kind of pave a runway right mm-hmm. here. It's just like sort of
so a drawer full of pregnancy tests but no condoms,
right?
Really?
Well, and of course they've all been theoretically sterilized in one way or another, but Jenny was not this is in the same chapter, so it's not much of a spoiler. All the tests suggested she was not going to be able to get pregnant, so they kind of left her alone. And that, you know, didn't go too well. Oops. In the end, and the vasectomy that Josh had did not take. But yeah, you know, it's a little suspicious to me that so the reality show has kind of died off by the time we get to the first chapter, because everyone's just sitting around growing spinach or crying in their lab and there's not much to film. But once the pregnancy happens, it starts up again. That seems a little suspicious to me. Like, so maybe did Mars One know that the real gold was going to be in making new life on Mars all along?
I think one of the
except it's not and Mars again, One, this, I should this, say it's Destination Mars in my book.
Right. Yeah, the different branding.
Yeah.
I have to say this would definitely be an environment where the increasingly popular gender reveal with explosion would be even more fraught. Mm-hmm. And so, for the sake of all involved, I'm torn between hoping that doesn't happen in the book and also sort of super duper wanting to see it happen. So,
well, I guess
why
did
they pack
to avoid
all these explosives?
Spoilers, I will just say a lot of crazy things happen, and I won't comment on specifics at this time.
There you go. So I started off by mentioning that this is an SF comedy. Mm. And so it makes me think that other than the sheer absurdity of Mars One, this has got to have roots places, right? This has got to have, because you're not, you're not new to this business of being an author. You have many books out, poetry and essays, and you've written short fiction and novels and other sorts of things. This is just your science fiction debut, as it were. So there had to be some set of influences there that were kind of percolating for you. Is this part Mel Brooks meets, you know, I don't know.
Either that, or you're successful as a quote unquote regular author, and then you lost a bet and had to do a science fiction novel. Like,
ooh, I was hoping that wouldn't come out. No,
it's like the music contract thing, where the fifth album, where you're just trying to get out of the contract, is the Christmas album. Exactly. You're just trying to get it done with.
No, I mean, I think in a certain sense, I was shocked to discover that I was writing science fiction. Just as I was shocked to discover that I wasn't before. There's something kind of arbitrary about all of it. I just tend to write out of states of confusion and bafflement. And, this Mars One thing that I found in the news baffled me. But previous, you know, the novel that came out before this, as a woman who's got bipolar disorder, and I've had people in my life close to me who've had bipolar disorder, and that is, in maybe a less hilarious way, fairly baffling. And so that sparked that in a sort of deep way. It's not different for me. It's like, I write because I don't understand things, and that writing maybe helps me get a little closer to understanding them. So this was just another case of that. So that's part one. Part two is, I think when I was just starting out, I felt like you have to be very serious to write. You have to write out of a place of great seriousness, or else, you know, it's point. It doesn't do anything for anybody. It has no meaning. It's no depth. Yeah. And yet I think humor, I mean, I take in a lot of humor. I love humor. I think humor, I once heard a guy named Dylan Kreider talk about humor as the thing that intensifies surrounding emotions. So if you want something to be scary, make it funny. Horror movies are often very funny. You know, you want something to be sad, make it funny, and that'll make it more sad. Which I've found to be the case a lot. So I've sort of given up on this narrow sense of what a book ought to be, and that it ought to just focus on really intense emotions. I think without humor, it's incomplete. And it feels like, I mean, maybe I leaned into it pretty heavily for this book, but I think it should always be there to some extent, or I feel like I'm hiding something or leaving something out.
I totally get what you're saying.
You see what I mean?
I get it, because when I started writing, I had this idea in my head that you, in order to be taken seriously, you had to write seriously.
Right.
Yeah.
And then I met Gail Carriger. And I read The Parasol Protectorate. Mm-hmm. And then I read, you know, Jim Butcher's books. Mm-hmm. And then I started seeing, you can have these kind of heavy things, but have humor throughout them, because we're human and we have humor. I mean, Tracy can tell you after a year and a half that I inject a ton of humor into this show all the time, mm-hmm. because I would prefer to make you laugh.
Right. So many other things can come in when people are already vulnerable through the laughing. You know, they've opened themselves up. An author that I really adore is Charles Yu, I think almost in the exact same moment, sad and funny. You know, he's certainly doing all the things. So I think it's more that. I mean, even the book, called Miss Portland, that's about this woman who's tried to escape her life, you know, with a bipolar disorder, who's run off to Maine. There's a lot of humor in there. She's in a kind of a manic phase. And, you know, as I know from the people in my life, that can be a lot of fun in a kind of scary way. There's humor everywhere. And some of it's tragic humor and some of it's just fun. And I'm interested in all of it.
I think the world of writing, particularly as it manifests itself in programs that try to teach writing, whether it's, you know, more informal ones like a workshop atmosphere, or more formalized ones like degree programs or MFAs or whatnot, often unintentionally do a disservice for people who decide that they want their experience of writing to be a program and like learning craft in that atmosphere, as opposed to just sort of winging it in a more organic way entirely on their own. Because often those programs have these kind of like in-baked narratives about what you ought not do and what you can't, you know, what you should do and what combines and what does not combine. Mm-hmm. And there's, of course, the the almost satirical figure now of the tweed jacketed professor who stands up in the front of the creative writing class and announces that this is a creative writing class. You must let your imaginations run free. No fantasy, science fiction, or horror stories, please. None of that silly stuff.
Right. Free within incredibly narrow confines. Right.
Yes. You're going to ride in the bike lane on this highway right here. And I think even for me, because I teach, my students are high schoolers. They're smart high schoolers. They're special high schoolers, but they are teenagers. And they're so used to being told what the limits are for things that when they come to my creative writing class and they're doing something and I'm like, you need this scene to be a lot funnier or like, you need the scene to be a lot weirder. They're like, can I do that? Is that okay? And I'm like, I am literally begging you to make this weirder and funnier. Be like, yes, please. Like, it is so much easier as a writer, I think, for us to, and I don't mean easier in the sense of like, it's literally easy to do, but in the sense of like, of your options, doing A or doing B. I think the easier move is to take it to 100 with whatever it is you're doing. And then later on revisions or something, maybe some kindly critique partner or editor or beta reader says, could you please stop being so extra? Like, could you do a little less of that? It's like with acting, you know, it's easier to take someone who overacts and tell them to calm the fuck down than it is to take someone who just can't get outside themselves and have them open up. Yep. You're not going to have that sort of like method acting moment where like suddenly they're sobbing and they become Marlon Brando. Like you have to take them from some space of like, whoa, champ, hang on.
I agree completely.
Contain that a little bit.
I think our job as teachers is to open all the doors and the windows, you know? I mean, to not cut stuff off. When I was in grad school, I was writing a lot of magic realism, and one prof came up to me and heard that I was doing that, and she said, "Oh, you'll get over that." And it was this really I was like, "Oh, I guess that's bad." You know, and I'm young and I guess I shouldn't do things that are bad. So, you know, so you just start to move away from that. Whereas here on the opposite, and this isn't really to my credit as a teacher because it was a mistake on my part, but it had good consequences, is the beginning of a semester. And so I just was starting to see their writing, you know, and I went to a reading and some of the students were coming to see this person read. And I saw one of the students and I said, "Hey, you know what? You've been doing really exciting work lately. Like, keep going." And she said, "Oh, really? Really? That's fantastic." And then she went and sat down and another student came in and I thought, "Oh, that's who I was thinking of." You know, it wasn't even this first person. And yet she went on to do amazing work. And I think it was partly because somebody quite mistakenly just like threw open the doors and the windows. So why we just should be doing this for all of our students, I think.
I will throw it out there that I took a creative writing class in college for one semester, only one semester, because they had teacher had the stricture, you know, no science fiction, fantasy, magic, nothing like that. You can't do that fake shit. This is creative writing. We're taking this serious.
Yep.
And so I did it for one semester and then I stopped. Yeah. I dropped it.
Yep.
What pisses me off specifically about that stricture is it has nothing to do. They always try to gaslight you into believing that it's because that stuff isn't really creative. It's all just sort of tropey, stereotypical nonsense. Yeah. As if there isn't tropey, stereotypical nonsense in other types of writing as well, but put that aside. Like what they're really saying, and they're telling on themselves when they do that, if your ear is attuned to it, is I don't read enough of that or understand it enough to know how to help you grow. And so I'm going to fix my own problem by forbidding you from doing the thing.
Yeah. Or I just don't like it.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like I don't,
that's what I run into
in my
family.
I can't put myself outside myself enough to.
Yeah. My family has never read anything that I've written because they all go, but that's like space shit and elves. You don't like that.
Are they together? At least I hope the space shit and the elves. Cause I mean, who doesn't want to see some space shit and elves together?
Not yet. Maybe in the future.
A little mashup sort of thing there.
It's true. Yeah. I mean, I think people are really weird.
In space.
Well, at least you've got the theme song already written. So that's
the runway's prepped there. I have to ask, because now I'm super curious. We kind of like dipped our toe in these waters. As someone who is a very thoughtful and academic and successful person who's written many serious things, and also now How to Mars, which is in some ways less serious, but also super serious, Is there something that you think if your colleagues or your students knew that you were into it, they would be like, really, David? Mm. Really? That seems so beneath you. Like, I have so many of those things that I think I could do an entire podcast channel that's like nothing but that. Like all of my like subhuman passions that I'm deeply engaged in. But yeah, wrestling. I love professional wrestling.
Oh yeah.
I'm down. Yeah.
I try to be very real with my students, certainly. I mean, so I don't think there's much I could do to throw them off. You know, I swear in class, I talk about things I like that they think are for normal people and not weirdos like me.
Yeah, wrong kind of weirdo.
Yeah, but I think it would be hard for me to lose my students. And I think, you know, I've heard things from my students about this book that I haven't, you know, about previous stuff that they're paying attention to, because they're like, oh, maybe this won't be like an IQ test, which I hope none of my stuff is. I hope it's all for humans.
What a backhanded compliment.
You know, right. But that's, you know, I think people look, they're like, a professor wrote this. Oh, I guess I'm still in school as I read this. Blah. You know, am I going to be tested on this later? My colleagues is possibly a different story, but I'll say this. I have a very weird position. So I teach creative writing and literature, but I do it in a Jewish studies program at Georgetown, which it's not the same as being in an English department. Because if you're in an English department, they think, oh, you're this childish weirdo who we know what you are. You kind of goof around and write books and stuff. In Jewish studies, they're like, are you in the right location? What? We didn't know you were coming. You know, the director was, actually, I love the current director and the previous director of the program. The previous director brought me in because Jewish studies always has the potential to become entirely Holocaust studies if you don't bring in some humanities. And it's important to me that Judaism not just be about who hates us, but all the cool stuff we're doing and have done. So that was something this director believed. And so he said, yeah, let's get creative. Let's have folks writing poetry and fiction and stuff. And so I think there's even less comprehension of what I am in that environment, but they're like, whatever class I propose, they say, yeah, do that. So I sort of think they're ready to go. I feel like everybody's ready to go. Yeah.
That's super cool.
So Tracy, I have to throw you a curveball.
Yeah. Let's do it.
Did you know that Hulk Hogan and the WWE/F had to pay Marvel a licensing fee every time Hulk Hogan appeared?
I didn't know that. Is that because of the? Is that because of the? Because
they owned Hulk.
The television show.
No, they owned Hulk.
Like the concept of Hulk.
They
like,
trademarked it. They copyrighted it. They owned it. And so when he appeared, they sued, and they won, and they settled.
Yeah.
And had to pay a licensing fee to Marvel anytime Hulk Hogan appeared.
In the early aughts, right around the WWF to WWE. Changeover, so to speak, there was a relatively short-lived character who went by the wrestling name of Gangrel. A few weeks back, listeners heard a podcast where we were interviewing a bunch of authors who had just done a triptych of Vampire the Masquerade RPG themed novellas, and those people who were listening to that episode and went, yeah, that's my jam, will know that Gangrel is a term from Vampire the Masquerade that refers to a specific clan of vampires that has a specific kind of aesthetic to them. And this dude's aesthetic was 100% that, and his whole, like, it was never stated in his like wrestler persona that he was a vampire, but he had ridiculously long teeth and he would often have like bloody stuff going on around the mouth, so it was definitely strongly winked at. Well, you could bet the World of Darkness people took WWE to the court about this. And this is sort of funny story here. You mentioned like, David, you mentioned the notion of like, oh, I can read this and maybe it's not an IQ test. One of the reasons I did as well as I did in high school on the AP language and literature test was literally entirely because I spent too much of my life playing World of Darkness branded tabletop role-playing games because the names of all of their weird ass werewolf clans and vampire powers and various other things, tribes, I should say, for werewolves, because it's clans, it's vampires. But anyway,
sure.
All their weird ass words were actual real words that are dug from like the deepest, darkest areas of the dictionary. So the WWE won the suit and was able to continue using the character and the word gangrel, because gangrel is an obscure old English word for someone who is an itinerant or sort of hobo. Pointed to that, and they were like, look, the sharp teeth thing is incidental. It's merely a point of confusion. All of these things which clearly signal vampires, just like, you're reading into that. He's just a murder hobo, is sort of what we're going for here. It's just pure murder hobo. And the court was like, murder hobo wins. And that was sort of like the end of that's definitely one of those places, one of those weird areas of my life where, like, being a geek and being, like, mildly socially dysfunctional paid certain dividends, where I was like, I know what the word vicissitude means. It probably means, in this context, something changing in unpredictable ways, because vicissitude is the power that allows you to manipulate flesh into weird, horrible golems. So there you go. This is all the ways... My misspent childhood has somehow resulted in something passing for intelligence.
I think they mostly do go the right way later on. It's like the childhood, I think you're like, this is forever. And someone's just got to whisper in your ear, like, this is going to pay off. Just hang in there.
I've always said this. I think a lot depends on who ends up influencing you.
Yeah.
So, and that can be a teacher, right? Mm. At some point. There are a couple of teachers that I had who stand out to me. You know, Miss Gano gave me The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings and told me to read them as an example, right? We're at a Catholic school and she's like, oh, you're bored. Here, read this. I think you'll really like it. Mm. There was a teacher in high school, Mrs. McDonald. She taught French and Latin. Of course, I'm taking Latin because I am that nerd. And she got me into mythology. Right. She starts handing me mythology and Roman history and Greek and on and on and on. So, you know, she stood out. And then I still remember there was a substitute teacher. I cannot remember his name to save my life. But the substitute teacher had an assignment for us where we had to write a short story where we are the protagonist and something's happening that we're doing. And I wrote this little story about how I was putting subliminal messages in textbooks all across America. In order to get high school students to vote for me for president when I turned 30. Mm. And it was like the science fiction-y kind of thing where, you know, they would be reading their textbooks and there would be these subliminal messages in there that would just convince them. Right. A lot different from what Bill Gates is doing right now with the second shot.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh yeah, sure.
Did he give you a B on the short story because you were supposed to be at 35 and you jumped the gun there?
The other thing was it had to be anonymous. You couldn't put your name on it.
Oh, okay. All
right. And what he did was he held it up to the class as the best story and said, this is the best story. I love this story. Whoever wrote this, you're a genius. Great job. And then the next day, the regular teacher came back and held up my story and said, this is bullshit. This is the worst thing anyone's written. This is absolute garbage.
Mm.
And that's when you learned about subjectivity.
Yeah, it depends on the person, right? Yeah, who kind of fosters your interest in things. I had a lot of people in my life who, fostered my interest in computers and technology, in science fiction and fantasy. I had people that I could talk to about Star Wars and Star Trek. And I went to the comic book store and I was that guy. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And I would go to the comic book store and spend $50 and then sit there for 2.5 hours talking to the two people who owned it, brother and sister, about every possible thing that you could, you know, it's like, oh, by the way, you guys have Robotech over there. And I really like Robotech. Can we talk about Robotech for like the next 25 minutes? Because I saw this thing called Macross and there was nudity in it and I'm scarred for life. Where did that come from? It looked like Robotech, but it wasn't Robotech and there was nudity. Minmay was nude. How the hell did that happen? You know, shit like that.
But, you know,
so it just depends on who fosters you.
Yeah, I think that teacher engaged. There was someone who came to Georgetown a little while back, a professor from I don't remember what college. Her name's Becky Weiling Packard, and she talks about mentorship, particularly for BIPOC students. But it's generally, I think, useful. Is it these moments of recognition? Someone saying, "Oh, you're doing a real thing. Like what you're doing is a valuable thing and you're participating in something that I care about and that you care about. And it's not that you're going to be doing it. You are already doing it." And I think that's unbelievably valuable. And something else I think as teachers that we need to be looking for opportunities to do. Jesse Lee Kercheval at University of Wisconsin when I was supposed to be studying to be a graduate student in psychology, and I was sneaking off taking creative writing classes. She was a great mentor to me, and she wrote a book about plot. It was really great structure and plot. And she was signing it for me at a reading, and she wrote, "To David, already a writer." And nice. I don't know, but her saying that was so powerful for me. You know, it really made me feel not like I could just aspire to do a thing, but
it's
maybe
like
I
receiving
your
knighthood. Yes. Like I have been identified. Yes. I have been given my laurels.
And then you have your mission, you know, if you choose to accept it, and not to mix metaphors.
Yeah, I mean,
no, that's fine. Spock was on that show.
Oh, so there you go.
Leonard Nimoy was a cast regular on the original Mission Impossible.
I'm not as up on the original ones. I hate to admit it. I'm more Tom Cruise era, but
I think I stopped watching the Tom Cruise ones around the 97th installment.
but the 98th,
I don't know. It's all sort
good.
Of a blur. Yeah, it's all just such a blur, you know. Like, how many more times can he like leap from the top of a building towards a helicopter and grab onto the runners below?
Now he jumps from a plane.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, that's different. That's different then.
The 98th is good. I would skip it after that, but not go to 98.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right.
Actually, I liked 99, the Hobbs and Shaw version.
Oh God, that. That's the only Fast and Furious movie I saw, and then I regretted I'd seen any of them.
I saw the first one, and that was it for me. I'm like, oh, okay, I'm not this audience.
They are Fast and Furious.
Yes.
About a month and a half, 2 months ago, started watching very belatedly. Patrick knows that I am not a good conversationalist when it comes to current TV because I just don't watch a lot of it. And that's not a virtue statement. That's a like, oh, Jesus, I wish I was watching more TV. But like, where is the time?
Sure.
But anyway, don't watch a lot of TV. So I'm always behind on the things people are supposed to be watching. So we started watching The Good Place as a family a couple months ago. Mm. And there's this moment in The Good Place where a demon character hands to another demon character a can of what is clearly an Axe body spray. And is like, here, we've developed a new type of body spray here. It smells like Michael Bay's Transformer movies sound. And like later a character comes in after a character who received Axe has hosed himself in it. And other character comes in is like, why do you smell loud and confusing? And it's sort of, it brings me to this moment.
I think that's one of the smartest shows that's been on TV in a long time, by the way.
Through the first two seasons. So be gentle with
Yeah,
with
I won't.
Your feet.
I will not say a thing about what's to come, but I'll just say, I think it is that perfect example of a thing that is funny in a very serious way.
Yeah, it is. And I'm watching it. When I say I'm watching it as a family, I'm actually kind of like gently deleting my son out of the equation. Not because I wouldn't watch it with him, but because he just didn't get on board when we started, and so now he's sort of behind. But I'm watching it with my husband and my 9-year-old daughter. And my 9-year-old daughter is like more deeply invested in understanding moral philosophy than a 9-year-old should be. Mm. I should stress that she, you know, is currently, as we speak, having a fight above my head with her brother about playing the Lego DC Batman game on the Switch because she didn't get to use the controller she prefers. So I don't know that it's like an advantageous interest, shall we say, in moral philosophy.
She's starting out. Yeah. She's starting out.
Yeah, it's just like baby steps, like training wheel and stuff.
We watched that as a family also, and then I immediately just watched the entire thing again because I just even think, and again, I won't do any spoilers, but at a plot level, they move through material so quickly on there. You know, the American TV so often is like, how long can I drag this out? And The Good Place is like, nope, I'm done with that idea and moving to the next level. And I just admire how reckless they are with their material in a way.
Right. There's a number of season enders where you're like, they shouldn't be able to make this work. I'm going into the next season pissed off. And you start watching it and you're like, God damn it.
Yeah.
They managed to make that twist work. And
it
like,
is
I
worth
thought
studying.
I was going to. Yeah.
Who's the showrunner / creator on that?
Michael Shore. Michael Shore.
I feel like it's from the same people who've done a lot of really smart shows that end up not lasting very long.
Well, Brooklyn Nine-Nine was one of his. Parks and Rec was also one of his. And I guess there's one that's coming out very, very imminently that I cannot remember the name of. Newport or something like that. It's about a small town.
Yeah,
that,
and it's only on Peacock. It's only on Peacock. Yeah. And that's Ed Helms.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
It's good if they don't last long. I mean, sometimes things go on and they become torture. You know, I think that's really well controlled and like they have an idea of where they're going and what it's going to do. And then they play it out. I kind of love that.
Well, yeah. I mean, Mike, much praise in the SF community tends to go towards Babylon 5 because the showrunner, the lore is that he always knew exactly how long it was going to be and exactly where it was going to go. And so it behaved as intended.
Yeah.
Yeah. The only problem is that at the end of every season, he was scrambling because they're like, are we going to keep this on? Are we going to cancel it? Mm-hmm. What are we going to do? And he's trying to wrap things up and get it to a point where it's like, if this is it,
it's still
done.
Okay. Yeah.
It's okay. And then like he'll do that. And then they say, eh, we're going to give you another season. Shit.
Totally.
Yeah.
How do I make
like,
another problem?
Five anyway. Yeah, yes.
And then you know the question always comes up: have you seen Mr. Garibaldi? I'm looking for my friend, Mr. Garibaldi.
All right. So I think are we feeling picks of the week? Are we feeling good for that? All right. I'm
Here,
ready when
you are. We'll even do some music.
Mm-hmm. Ooh. Picks of the week.
I love that smile. David got this big grin on his face. He's like, oh, there's music for picks. Nice.
Well, you folks, I got to say, I was meaning to say this right up front. You do great music. That intro music, first of all, I want to know what it is because it's excellent. And now you have music.
It kind of slaps. It's pretty good. Yeah.
We were all grooving. We were all popping our heads.
For 10 years, my co-host was John Anelio, who was a singer-songwriter and a teacher as well. And so he did the original theme music for us and the picks of the week music. So that's still him in the picks of the week. And then when he left, our theme music was really slow. And I mean, it was good and it was nothing wrong with it, but it was slow.
A sweet little acoustic.
Yeah.
Ballad
John,
thing.
He's Patrick together with the functional nerds. And I wanted something that popped a little bit. So I actually went out to a royalty free library and I found that, and I purchased it for us. So
I Shazammed the opening music and I got nothing. So I'm really glad to like just at least have the origin story a little bit. Because I was listening to these previous episodes and I said, I got to know, but it didn't work out.
Yeah, I had to pay for it. So it's royalty free. So Shazam probably doesn't have it in their library. But I can send you a link if you want to go out there and see. Because it actually has a bunch of tracks.
Oh, cool.
So it's not just that one. It does, you know, it does a full track. It does a partial intro. And I just kind of put them together into what we're using right now.
Nice.
Yeah. All right. So, Patrick, I think I started Picks of the Week when we talked to Sarah before. Do you want to start this time and then we'll have David go? Okay.
Sure. So I am still being lazy / not motivated to do a lot of things, which, you know, comes and goes. It comes and goes.
Yeah.
Like for a couple weeks there, I was like, oh, I'm walking every day. Let's go for a walk. Let's eat right. And then suddenly I'm like, Haagen-Dazs is eating right. And I can just sit on my ass and play a video game, right?
It's calcium.
I have a ton of video games that I haven't played. I'm just sitting in my library on my PS4. And I plan to buy a PS5 about 6 months before they announce the PS6 is coming. That way, you know, I stay consistent with my track record of waiting too long to buy a new system. But right now I'm playing Dishonored 2. If you're not familiar with the Dishonored franchise, you're essentially a rogue. Okay. If you like to play a rogue and you like to sneak around but you have a little bit of magic.
Okay. Yeah.
That's the Dishonored model. And in the first one, the queen is killed and her bodyguard turns rogue trying to figure out what happened. And he's trying to save her daughter.
Okay.
Here's the spoiler, who turns out to be his daughter. And in the second one, you can either play him or the daughter, who's all grown up. You can pick. And if you play through as one and then you play through as the other one, you can do a third playthrough and combine all of their powers and stuff and play a third one through. As a lot of people who know me will say, patience, like I'm a very, very patient person and I will take a lot of shit from people too, you know, before I finally get angry. And so like I'm very patient. except when I'm playing video games. And so what happened was, and I was talking to Giles from Beyond the Trope podcast about this, and because he and I chat a lot, and especially about video games. And I was like, I'm playing Dishonored 2. He's like, oh, I love that game. I said, yeah. And I went through the entire first level of the whole game and got to the second level. And then it gives you a screen where it says, you know, what did you achieve? He's like, yeah. And I said, so you have to collect runes. I collected 0 runes. You have to collect bone charms. I collected 0 bone charms out of like 10. You're supposed to collect paintings. I didn't find any paintings. You're supposed to collect coins. There was like 4,000 coins that you could collect. I got 30.
This sounds right. Like what happens when I send my kids out to Cooper Scoop the yard. And they're like, nope, didn't find anything. It's the damnedest thing.
I burned through this level not playing the game correctly at all. And so I started over. And the thing is, you have to look up. You have to look down. You have to use the heart. So you get the heart, which is actually her mother's heart. And it's got her mother's spirit in it. And the heart, you can hold it in your hand and you can point it and it'll find runes and bone charms for you. It'll just start beating. Dum, 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 dum. And then you can hit a button and she'll start talking to you. She's like, there's something nearby. I wish that I could just sleep and stop this endless nightmare. You know, it's like very dark and moody. You can point her at someone, the heart at someone, and learn their innermost secrets, right? She like reads their mind. So I didn't do any of that the first round. So I went back and I started over and I told Giles and he was laughing. And then I went through and I did it the right way. And I'm like looking up. I'm like, oh shit, there's an open window. I can climb up into that window. And sure enough, I go in there and here's a painting and here's a bone charm and here's a blah, blah, blah.
I'm just picturing
blah.
You like tanking as a rogue through the game where you're supposed to rogue through everything.
Yes. And that's the other thing. God. Depending on how you play the game, like if you can sneak up behind someone, you can pickpocket and then you can grab them and choke them out and make them unconscious and then drag their body off somewhere and hide it. If you do that, you're playing low chaos. If like me, because I didn't completely start the game over. I basically backtracked to the beginning and started over by going, okay, I'm back at the beginning. Let me look around. What do I do now? And then I started doing stuff. At that point, I had already created a high chaos game by killing a bunch of people.
Oops.
So now I'm in this high chaos game where it's like, they see me and they're like, holy shit, it's you. We got to kill you.
Everybody's on red alert.
Yeah. Everybody's on red alert. So I'm. This is why I never could play Assassin's Creed, because Assassin's Creed's like, okay, what you have to do is you have to walk like this, very slowly through the town, and I would take 4 steps and be like, nah, fuck this, I'm running.
So I hate to be a spoiler here, but I'm I'm waiting to hear the part where this is a pick of the week that where you're like, yes, do this. I had such fun.
It's a fun game, but you have to understand the mechanics of it. You have to play it a certain way. You have to hunt and look for things. And sometimes it's not obvious. Like you will just see that there's a window open and then you notice there's like 5 awnings that kind of lead up to that where you could jump up to the awnings and climb from awning to awning to awning to get to the window. And that's the only way to get to that apartment.
Nerdlings, do you want to play the Don't Be Patrick simulator? Play Dishonored 2. Oh, David, how about you? What's your pick?
Well, it seems to me like our theme for this episode is just like being open, you know, seeing the runes, you know, seeing your students' potential. I, you know, to go to the healthy eating idea that you named, Patrick, Dunkaroos are going to have to my pick of the week. And I'll tell you why that's about openness. I think we can all agree that Cookie Crisp is not as good of a cereal as it ought to be. You know, you go to eat it and you think this is going to be like chocolate chip cookies in a bowl.
No, it's like the worst chocolate chip cookies in a bowl.
It's like the worst chocolate chip cookies in a bowl. And so I was in a CVS and they were selling Dunkaroos for like a nickel. And I thought, well, it's cheap. So
they're probably not even spoiled.
Right. Yeah. So even though they're corn-based cookie simulated cereal items, I thought, let's give it a shot. And the truth is, it's a whole other world. I can tell you both quite honestly, it's a whole other scenario. And I'm happy with my Dunkaroos. So you have to just stay open is, I guess, the thing that I'm trying to express here.
I've never tried Dunkaroos, but back in the day, I did have Underoos.
Yeah, but
you could get Dunkaroos and eat them in Underoos. You could just have the full package right now.
You have to just get those in the right order, because if you're in Dunkaroos and you eat Underoos, it's a totally different experience.
Yeah. That would actually be one of the few things that's worse than Cookie Crisp.
Yeah.
Right there.
What is it with Cookie Crisp? It's so bad. But anyway.
All they need is for one foolish mother to buy that box, right? Yeah. And if they have just enough first time foolish, harried mothers of preschoolers who give in and buy the box, then there's enough other cereals to carry the brand, I think. Yeah.
So basically you're saying it's full profit when you buy that box. It's just all profit.
Yeah.
Apparently so.
So it's like when the truck crashed that was carrying the ramen and they lost like 40 tons of ramen, and Marichon said, you know, that's going to hit our profits for 40 cents.
Yeah. That's worth nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not a, I'm afraid that we're just going to be reeling from that in this next quarterly report.
So that's my pick of the week. Dunkaroos.
Continuing the theme of wild and radical openness here, one of the things that has brought my son in particular, but also us just as a family and you know, connecting with different friend groups, a lot of joy, has been Jackbox games. So they're pretty well known now. The whole You Don't Know Jack franchise started in the mid to late 1990s with CD-ROM based games. But it's since expanded and grown into a whole bevy of packaged games, most of which you can get on Steam, oftentimes for pretty good deals, that are basically just sort of different social party games that are sort of like twisted ripoffs of things like Pictionary or whatnot. And so if you have been looking for something where if you've got a Discord server where you hang out with people from time to time, or if you've got some ability to do a get together with folks, but you don't, you know, like me, I'm in the basement here, this is like the C game level shelf. And Patrick knows that I think the census of games in Shea Townsend is something like 400 games at this rate. It's a lot.
Wow.
It's a lot. Normal people don't do this. But anyway, If you're the sort of person who doesn't have a lot of physical games around, but you want games that you can get a lot of mileage around socially and socially distanced, go into the Jackbox games. Jackbox Party Pack 7 is one of the more recent releases, and we've been getting a lot of mileage out of that one. So I recommend people check it out.
Yeah.
All right. So we have to make sure that as this episode should be dropping the day that How to Mars publishes, which would be amazing.
Yeah.
And so we're hoping that everything turns out with that as it should be on May 25th. Where should people find you, David, in this here Etherverse and beyond?
Well, I have an irritating to spell last name, so I'm just going to say, you know, look at the web page that you're on, but davidiebenbach.com. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Instagram. I'm one of the rare weirdos who uses his real name on Reddit, on Facebook. But davidiebenbach.com is a good place to start.
You know, years ago, I got to interview an up-and-coming author who had just had like a breakthrough debut SF novel, Lauren Bucus. And she was like, she's South African. And she's like, if I had known that Americans were going to have such a hard time with my name, I would have used a pen name.
Oh, wow.
It's too late for me, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm proud of my last name. It means level stream. So it means my ancestors were really happy to be near a kind of a boring river that wasn't even doing very much. And that's charming. Well, I like that.
Yeah, that's fun.
There you go.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. This has been wonderful.
Well, we're happy to have you part of our slightly less than entirely level stream here. Take care, David.
You too. Thanks.
God dang it. Now Edmund is pissed at me. Doesn't he get enough mentions actually on Beyond the Trope, on their podcast itself, without sending me nasty emails about not being included in these end bumpers, along with Hobbs and Shadow and Dell? But no, Edmund doesn't want to be left out. Who even gave him his own email account and access to a computer? Who does that? This is how the world ends. We give cats email addresses. Fine. Love you, Edmund. You're awesome. Kind of like the podcast you lounge around and listen to being recorded, Beyond the Trope, for 7 years. They've been kicking out episodes while you've been laying on that table. Every episode is kind of extra nerdy because Edmund is right there, keeping Giles and Michelle on track as they interview best-selling authors, award-winning actors, and other leaders in the creative community who all meet with Edmund's approval. Highly recommend you check out their podcast and keep Edmund happy, for God's sake. Then, when you're done with that, guess what? You also have to keep Hobbs and Shadow happy by checking out patreon.com/functionalnerds. If you like what we do and want our cats to stop puking in our shoes because they want the good cat chow, consider backing us for a couple bucks a month. Now, are all the animals happy? Am I done?